I'm always drawn back to places where I've lived, the houses and their neighborhoods. For instance, there's a brownstone in the East 70s where, during the early years of the war, I had my first New York apartment. It was one room crowded with attic furniture, a sofa and fat chairs, upholstered in that itchy particular red velvet that one associates with hot days on a train. The walls were stucco and a color rather like tobacco spit. The single window looked out on a fire escape. Even so, it was a place of my own. The first. And my books were there, and jars of pencils to sharpen. Everything I needed, so I felt, to become the writer I wanted to be. It never occurred to me in those days to write about Holly Golightly. And probably it would not now, except for a conversation I had with Joe Bell that set the whole memory of her in motion again. Holly Golightly had been a tenant in the old brownstone. She'd occupied the apartment below mine. As for Joe Bell, he ran a bar around the corner on Lexington Avenue. He still does. Both Holly and I used to go there 6-7 times a day, not for a drink, not always, but to make telephone calls. During the war, a private telephone was hard to come by. Moreover, Joe Bell was good about taking messages, which in Holly's case was no small favor, for she had a tremendous many. Of course, this was a long time ago, and until last week, I hadn't seen Joe Bell in several years. Occasionally, I'd stop by his bar when passing through the neighborhood. But actually, we'd never been strong friends, except in as much as we were both friends of Holly Golightly. And so, when late last Tuesday afternoon, the telephone rang and I heard,
"Joe Bell here."
I knew it must be about Holly. He didn't say so, just,
"Can you rattle right over here? It's important."
And there was a croak of excitement in his froggy voice. I took a taxi in a downpour of October rain, and on my way I even thought she might be there, that I would see Holly again. But there was no one on the premises except the proprietor. Joe Bell's is a quiet place compared to most Lexington Avenue bars. It boasts neither neon nor television. Behind the bar, in a niche surrounded by photographs of ice hockey stars, there's always a large bowl of fresh flowers that Joe Bell himself arranges with matronly care. That is what he was doing when I came in.
"Naturally,"
he said, rooting a gladiolus deep into the bowl.
"Naturally, I wouldn't have got you over here if it wasn't I wanted your opinion. A very peculiar thing has happened."
"You heard from Holly?"
"I can't exactly say I heard from her. I mean, I don't know. That's why I want your opinion. Let me build you a drink. Something new. They call it a white angel,"
he said, mixing one half vodka, one half gin, no vermouth. While I drank the result, Joe Bell stood sucking on a Tums and turning over in his mind what he had to tell me. And then,
"You recall a certain Mr. I.Y. Uniashi, a gentleman from Japan?"
"From California," I said, recalling Mr. Uniashi perfectly. "He's a photographer on one of the picture magazines, and when I knew him, he lived in the studio apartment on the top floor of the brownstone."
"Don't go mixing me up. All I'm asking, you know who I mean, okay? So, last night, who comes waltzing in here but the self-same Mr. I.Y. Uniashi? I haven't seen him, I guess it's over 2 years. And where do you think he's been these 2 years?"
"Africa." Joe Bell's eyes narrowed.
"So how do you know?"
"Read it in Winchell." Which I had, as a matter of fact. He rang open his cash register and produced a manila envelope.
"Well, see, did you read this in Winchell?"
In the envelope were three photographs, more or less the same, though taken from different angles. A tall, delicate Negro man, wearing a calico skirt, displaying in his hands an odd wood sculpture, an elongated carving of a head, a girl's, her hair sleek and short as a young man's, her smooth wood eyes too large and tilted in the tapering face. On a glance, it resembled most primitive carving. And then it didn't. For here was the spit image of Holly Golightly.
"Now, what do you make of that?"
said Joe Bell. "It looks like her,"
Listen, boy.
He slapped his hand on the bar.
It is her. Sure as I'm a man fit to wear breeches. The little Jap knew it was her the minute he saw her.
He saw her? In Africa?
Well, just the statue there, but it comes to the same thing. Read the facts for yourself,
he said, turning over one of the photographs. On the reverse was written, Wood Carving, S. Tribe, Tokokul, East Anglia, Christmas Day, 1956. The story was this. On Christmas Day, Mr. Yuniashi had passed with his camera through Tokokul, a village in the tangles of nowhere and of no interest. He decided to move on when he saw suddenly a Negro squatting in a doorway, carving monkeys on a walking stick. Mr. Yuniashi was impressed and asked to see more of his work. Whereupon, he was shown the carving of the girl's head. But when he offered to buy it, the Negro cupped his private parts in his hand, apparently a tender gesture comparable to tapping one's heart, and said, No. A pound of salt and $10, a wristwatch and 2 pounds of salt and $20, nothing swayed him. Mr. Yuniashi was, in all events, determined to learn how the carving came to be made. It cost him his salt and his watch. But it would seem that in the spring of that year, a party of three white persons had appeared out of the brush, riding on horseback, a young woman and two men. The men, both red-eyed with fever, were forced for several weeks to stay shut and shivering in an isolated hut, while the young woman, having presently taken a fancy to the woodcarver, shared the woodcarver's mat.
I don't credit that part,
Joe Bell said squeamishly.
I know she had her ways, but I don't think she'd be up to anything as much as that.
And then?
Then nothing,
he shrugged.
By and by she went like she come, rode away on a horse. Now the Jap, he asked about her up and down the country, but nobody else had ever seen her.
And then it was as if he could feel my own sense of letdown transmitting itself to him, and he wanted no part of it.
One thing you gotta admit, it's the only definite news in I don't know how many years.
She's probably never set foot in Africa, I said, believing it. And yet, I could see her there. It was somewhere she would have gone.
You know so much? Where is she?
Dead or in a crazy house? Or married? I think she's married and quieted down and maybe right in this very city.
No,
he said.
If she was in this city, I'd have seen her. You take a man that likes to walk, a man like me. A man's been walking in the streets going on 10 or 12 years, and all those years he's got his eye out for one person. And nobody's ever heard. Don't you stand to reason she's not there? I see pieces of her all the time. A flat little bottom, any skinny girl that walks fast and straight.
He paused.
You think I'm round the bend?
It's just that I didn't know you'd been in love with her. Not like that. I was sorry I'd said it. It disconcerted him. He scooped up the photographs and put them back in their envelope. I looked at my watch. I hadn't any place to go, but I thought it was better to leave. Outside, the rain had stopped, so I turned a corner and walked along the street to where the brownstone stands, midway in the block. It's been sleeked up since my day. A smart black door has replaced the old frosted glass, and gray, elegant shutters frame the windows. No one I remember still lives there except Madame Safia Spanella, a husky coloratura who every afternoon went roller skating in Central Park. I know she's still there because I went up the steps and looked at the mailboxes. It was one of these mailboxes that at first made me aware of Holly-Golightly. I'd been living in the house about a week when I noticed that the mailbox belonging to apartment 2 had a name slot fitted with a curious card. It read, Miss Holiday Golightly, and underneath, in the corner, Traveling. It nagged me like a tune. Miss Holiday Golightly, Traveling. One night, it was long past 12, I woke up at the sound of Mr. Yuniashi calling down the stairs. His voice fell through the whole house.
Miss Golightly, I must protest.
The voice that came back was silly young and self-amused.
Oh, darling, I am sorry. I lost the goddamn key.
You cannot go on ringing my bell. You must please, please have yourself key made.
But I lose them all. Oh, don't be angry, you dear little man. I won't do it again. And if you promise not to be angry...
A voice was coming nearer. She was climbing the stairs.
I might let you take those pictures we mentioned.
By now I'd left my bed and opened the door an inch. I could hear Mr. Yuniashi's silence. Hear, because it was accompanied by an audible change of breath.
When?
He said. The girl laughed.
Sometime, she answered,
slurring the word.
Any time,
he said, and closed his door. I went out into the hall and leaned over the banister, just enough to see without being seen. She reached the landing, and the ragbag colors of her boy's hair, tawny streaks, strands of albino blonde and yellow, caught the hall light. It was a warm evening, and she wore a slim, cool black dress, black sandals, a pearl choker. For all her chic thinness, she had an almost breakfast cereal air of health, a soap and lemon cleanness. Her mouth was large, her nose upturned. A pair of dark glasses blotted out her eyes. I thought her anywhere between 16 and 30. As it turned out, she was shy 2 months of her 19th birthday. She was not alone. There was a man following behind her. He was short and vast, sun-lamped and pomaded, with a red carnation withering in his lapel. When they reached her door, she rummaged in her purse in search of a key and took no notice of the fact that his thick lips were nuzzling the nape of her neck. At last, though, finding the key and opening her door, she turned to him cordially.
Bless you, darling. You were sweet to see me home.
Hey, hey, baby.
Yes, Harry?
Harry was the other guy. I'm Sid. I'm Sid Auerbach. You like me.
I worship you, Mr. Auerbach, but good night, Mr. Auerbach.
Mr. Auerbach stared in disbelief as the door shut firmly.
Hey, baby. Let me in, baby. You like me. I'm a liked guy. Didn't they pick up the check? 5 people. Your friends. I never seen them before. Don't they give me the right you should like me?
He tapped on the door gently and then louder. Finally, he took several steps back, as though he meant to charge it. Instead, he plunged down the stairs, slamming a fist against the wall. Just as he reached the bottom, the door of the girl's apartment opened, and she poked out her head.
Oh, Mr. Auerbach!
He turned, a smile of relief oiling his face. She'd only been teasing.
The next time a girl wants a little powder room change, she called,
not teasing at all,
take my advice, darling. Don't give her 20 cents.